From simple to gourmet, nothing's fresher or tastier in recipes than homegrown, vine-ripened veggies and savory herbs. Do you grow your own? With Bonnie Plants, a kitchen garden at your back door or in containers can produce an amazing harvest for cooking and for sharing. Find how-tos, plans, and more at BonniePlants.com. Your recipes might not change, but your results sure will. Fresh, healthy Bonnie veggies and herbs. Get growing.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
And you're listening to Just Food Stories, airing live on heritageradionetwork.org. If you missed the live broadcast, you can always find us archived at heritageradionetwork.org and as a podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just Food is a nonprofit organization committed to helping people build community food projects. We know that people all over New York City know that we need to change our food system, and they want to make that change. But so often, people don't even know where to start. So we'd like to take the next half hour and introduce you to some of the people who started, taking their passions and their skills to bring change. Hopefully their stories will inspire you to create your own Just Food story. Today, I am so excited to be talking with Ben Towell, who started his career at the age of 16, working with internationally acclaimed restaurateurs and chefs such as Gordon Ramsay, Raymond Blanc, and Rick Stein, both in the United Kingdom and in the States. In 2008, Ben founded catering and events company Silkstone with friend and business partner Philip Windsor. Since its creation, Silkstone has become one of New York's leading creative events agencies, developing luxury brands throughout the states using innovative event design, marketing campaigns, and digital strategy. Towell then went on to create renowned New York City eatery, the Fat Radish, serving a menu best described as elevated home cooking, my favorite, using local seasonal vegetables and sustainably sourced proteins. Towell opened Silkstone's second restaurant, Rush Meyer's in Montauk, Long Island, focusing on simple local seafood. Soon after, he opened the Lead Belly Oyster Bar and the East Pole in Manhattan's Upper East Side. He also completed his first book, The Fat Radish Food Diary, to be released in 2014 with Rizzoli. Welcome, Ben.
Thanks so much.
Yay. So we've been talking a little bit about your story. And, you know, this is where we get into the good stuff, kind of, because there's a rich history behind every foodie in our experience. And there tends to be sort of this moment where you go from not thinking much about food to thinking a lot about food. And then when you start thinking a lot about food, you start to think a lot about food systems. And a lot of people that we've talked to who just love food became activists almost inadvertently. So tell me a little bit about your story.
Well, I think it's funny because when you read out someone's bio at the beginning, it always mentions people of note who they've worked for, things that they've done. But really, it's, as we're saying, it's the backstory that gets you to that point.
Right.
And so, yeah, I didn't really have any interest in food. Growing up, my mum was a great cook, but we, you know, I love sport. And
where did you grow up?
I grew up all over the south of England. We used to hop around, but my mum had a tea room in the Cotswolds and used to run bed and breakfasts.
That's awesome.
So it sounds very romantic, but
it does.
Yeah, it really wasn't. And so we would. You know, I just food wasn't really a subject. My aunt and uncle, who I spent half the year with, had a farm, but it was just a chore. They had 1,000 geese, they had about 300 sheep, a bunch of horses, and I just looked at that as manual.
Work.
I was free manual
right.
labor. So, but I really did understand farming. I knew what went into it. I knew that there wasn't much money in it. I knew, you know, I really saw it day to day. And then when I was 16, I got sick with chronic fatigue.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of those things that the British health system, as good as it is, you can't really test for that. Basically, what happens is you
just feel sick for a long time.
Out, you know. So I looked at alternative ways. After about 6 months, sleeping 20 hours a day, I had to do something about this because there wasn't a magic pill. Mm. And so I started seeing some nutritionists, and it was very fringe.
Were there nutritionists in England?
They'd come and they'd trained in the States.
Right.
And you know, growing up in the UK, I always say this to people, but like the States was this place where like big things happened, and it really had that feeling. And so if a doctor had come from, you know, the US and was talking about nutrition and diet in of ways of getting your, you know, healing, it was just such a foreign idea. But I did go and see someone, and he put me on a very, very strict diet, which was essentially, you know, now it would be, it's like a macrobiotic diet, but it was just super simple, plant-based diet, lots of grains.
Funny, right, that is a diet, you know, that's like, oh, wow, what a great idea for a cure, when it's basically the way people were eating for thousands of years, right?
It's wild, and it's amazing to see when you start eating like that, having not even thought about food before, how the body just begins to heal itself. And it's just not talked about. So age 16, I was just blown away by what was happening. Mm-hmm. And I had to look on the back of every single ingredient. On everything I bought, because I wasn't out of sugar, I wasn't out anything. So I started looking, having never looked before, I had to look on everything, and I just could not believe how complicated things were. I mean, you think that, you know, even stuff that was labeled or looked healthy was, I just couldn't have. So I took my, I was living for a bit with my grandmother, who is now 98. But at the time she was in her 80s, and she also couldn't believe this.
Right.
You know, this is a woman who was born in 1917, 1918. And she just couldn't believe how much stuff was in food as well.
And she had probably witnessed the whole industrialization process of food.
Somehow,
because
we had this farm, I think she missed quite a lot of it.
Right.
Anyway, so the whole sort of experiment with myself on nutrition and food, I got back on my feet, and I was just so enamored by how powerful this subject
food is. Can be.
And how big this, and I couldn't believe it'd never been a discussion. I went to like a great school, I had a great education, and not once had anyone discussed food. So it just blew my mind. And so then I ended up working I got a job as a chef working for Raymond Blanc, who was sort of a pioneer of organic food in the early 80s. And that's where it all began, in terms of I got into the restaurant business, which took me a little bit away from that sort of personal journey. And then I loved the restaurant business. It kind of brought that sports thing back, because it's
right. You were rigorously training for like the big game.
That's what big kitchens feel like. Yeah. So it had both those elements. So it was that's how I got into the restaurant business, and I've always maintained this huge interest in how food affects us, where it comes from, and how it affects those who produce it. Because of my background growing up in a rural community, I never lost an understanding of the decisions that people make through restaurants, how that affects growers in the country, and what you grow. So, like, if you sell 1,000 geese at Christmas, like we used to, you'll do 1,200 geese next year.
Right.
And we used to see that, because there was this massive, like, people wanted to eat geese and British goose. So I always remember that connection.
Right.
And so I worked for Rick Stein down in Cornwall, and after Raymond Blanc, and fascinatingly, I got down there, and when I went back to London after working for Rick, I was screaming at a fish guy that I couldn't get fish one day in London at the restaurant I was working at. And I realized that, because I'd lived in a fishing community where Rick Stein's restaurant was, that fishermen do not go out in hurricanes. And if there's a hurricane or bad weather,
right.
So it doesn't matter how much that person wants it, it's someone's livelihood, and there's the disconnect between wanting a final product and looking at all the factors that affect people.
It's so funny because what you're saying reminds me of when we had, and this is such a silly little story, but when we had the hurricane last year, was last year or 2 years ago, I was in a restaurant and there was a table in Manhattan and there was a table next to me of women who were really angry that they couldn't get a salad. And they had forgotten, I mean, or maybe they just never knew that we were on an island and that it wasn't going to get, there were people, forget about the fact that, you know, there were people who lost their homes, you know, I'm not even going to that extreme. They just couldn't understand where, you know, why the salad just wasn't magically appearing, you know, and the server was trying to explain, well, you know, nothing's getting here. We have what we have kind of in the larder, you know,
and that's it.
I mean, and you know, I was thinking like, gosh, if, you know, unfortunately it takes that kind of event for people to understand that we live on an island and we have a food system that is very, very heavily dependent on transportation.
Yeah.
And if you don't have transportation, you don't get food, you know? So it's similar to...
No, it's just having that understanding of a connection between people who produce it and people who consume.
And a lot of that connection between producer and consumer, I think, you know, you and I were talking about a little bit, gets lost when you have a highly industrialized system and when you have a lot of people living in urban communities. And I think what we're trying to do now, I mean, the urban movement is not slowing down. Clearly more and more people are moving to cities and that's just the trajectory of the planet.
Yeah.
But hopefully, you know, through organizations like Just Food and all these other sort of urban agriculture programs that are happening, people are starting to recognize that, well, we live in the city, but we are still, you know, you still need to grow things to make food. So how are we going to do that?
And that's something that I found so fascinating. Being from, you know, from England, it's obviously so small, but when I was training as a chef and I left England when I was 21, and there was kind of the food movement that was happening was all about going back to regional recipes and local food and you know, being British and but it was really pretty fringy and there was no distribution networks for farmers to produce CSAs. It wasn't really there.
Right.
And in America, I was back to like the totally enamored by America thing. It was happening. Like it was, you know, you read about these sort of pioneers who were really the most incredible farmers markets, restaurants that were only buying from them. And actually, since I've been here, obviously the UK is so small, but the, you know, you go to a petrol station, a gas station in England, and like everything's like British, you know, freshly made British sandwiches and great produce and everyone really cares about it. So it's gone on and there's been so many great people there who've just done awesome things with school foods.
Yeah, I was going to say, today's actually a potentially big day for school food in New York City because the mayor's coming out with his executive budget today. And we're hoping that free universal lunch is on that budget list of, you know, it's been a topic of discussion in New York City. So that all children can get free school lunch, not just... you know, there's sort of there's a stigma right now, unfortunately, for the 75% of kids who are eligible for the free, as they call it. A lot of them by high school, like 38% of the kids actually take the lunch from school because of the stigma. So they don't want to be labeled, as needing free lunch. So you make it free for everybody. Everyone's invested in the system. Then we can really start to make some progress. But England actually, I mean, at least from my understanding as a New Yorker, and I don't know if it's just, you know, a Jamie Oliver thing or, you know, what exactly the story
he
is.
He had such a huge impact.
But they seem to have been doing a really good job over there with school lunch.
And
England wasn't known for its great food.
And that's what I was saying. Right. Oh, it's really,
right.
You know, and that's what, you know, Jamie and lots of other people are just been just these pioneers of forcing change through, you know, collectively getting everyone together. And, right. and so it was really interesting. And at the Just Food conference, mm-hmm. What you were discussing was a big part of one of the lectures I was in. And yeah, fascinating. I'm a New York school food. They purchase this. They're the second largest purchaser of food in the U.S.
It's something, and schools are right behind prisons, I think, or it's something like that. That's the army, and then prisons, and then schools.
Yeah, it's wild.
I mean, we can definitely, if we start making a change with institutional, setting food, then obviously things are going to follow.
Yeah.
So then after, so you moved to New York. I'm
yes.
still in the story because so, I like okay. the story
the
a
story.
Lot.
Back to the story. So, I've trained as a chef with Raymond Blanc. Absolutely, the most hardest period of my life in terms of it was like being in the army.
Right.
And then I went down to Cornwall, learned all about fish and what is on the coast, and then up to London, and then got to New York to work for Gordon Ramsay to open this restaurant here. And that was kind of a pretty exciting time to be a young guy moving to New York, and Gordon right. Ramsay was sort of this big superstar.
Right.
It was a very different experience from this town of 3,000, which was a working fishing town that I'd left in England, to be going down like two stories below ground to like
right.
prep vegetables in
right.
New York.
But yes.
I worked for him. And he was doing all sorts of television stuff that I would travel around and follow him behind him doing that around the US. And then after sort of ending up, I think, on the Home Shopping Network right. at 2 a.m,
right.
I thought that time for a change.
Yes.
I've really lost my way.
Holding, like displaying with your two hands, like lovingly caressing a pot that
Bridget Jones
right. style. Yeah, that's awesome.
So yeah, that was an interesting... interesting experience. And then I was going to leave here, and a friend who was opening a restaurant called the Kingswood, I came down to help with that. And that was an amazing experience, just to see what it's like to open a restaurant,
open a restaurant in
New York at a young age. And really, I loved seeing that happen from mm-hmm. the ground up. And I thought, well, I could do this one day.
It really is a labor of love too. I don't have a restaurant, but I have a food business, and there's a cafe, and we have it's basically, the economics of a restaurant more or less. And I was talking to my accountant, and she's very funny. And she was saying that, everyone thinks every other restaurant is so successful and the chefs are like killing it. And, none of us are in it because, obviously there are a few, very, very few who are, but it's not the restaurant that's making all the money. It's the branding or the personal appearances or the, sort of other things, those other little legs of the businesses. But, she said it's funny because it's still so romanticized. And it is such a labor of love, and it's so exhausting. And
I think you should always just go and talk to an accountant who has restaurant clients if you want to open a restaurant.
She's so funny. She's just like, so what? And I said, so what's your advice? And she's like, you need to just sell more. I kind of could have figured that out myself, And she's like, that's what I say to all my clients. It's pretty simple, sell more. And I'm like,
It's definitely a labor of love, but it's an exciting thing. And it's a place where you can, really evoke conversation and change.
Yes.
And they can be very, very powerful ambassadors of movements. And
right.
so without them, the one we're sitting in, was such a catalyst for change. And
right. It is amazing because, the thing about food is that, it's political, it's about money, it's about class, it's about,
taste.
Ethnicity. It's a lot about taste, but it's like it's human behavior embodied.
Yeah.
And so for anyone who enjoys trying to make sense, on a theoretical level at all of human behavior and what drives people and what connects people and what separates people, food is sort of like the ultimate lens.
It is.
Yeah.
It really is.
And having a place, where you get to sort of have that discussion, but in a tangible way mm-hmm. is for most of us in this world the whole key, you know, the dream of it, kind of. Totally. Which is where the fat radish comes in, kind of, right?
Yeah, and so the fat radish, it really did start as that, and it embodied a food philosophy that Phil and I had sort of shared together growing up, and then that I had really developed through my own personal journey of healing myself and mm-hmm. and the power of food, and so it was predominantly vegetarian, and then it was sourced locally, and when we started it was much harder to buy directly from right. people, and it's amazing how that's changed in the last 4 years.
I saw a Sysco truck that said something about like local farmers. I was like, Sysco?
No, but they are doing it. And that's a classic case of
how the market changes.
So that's why restaurants, you know, that's why it's powerful.
Yeah.
So
we're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with Just Food Stories on heritageradionetwork.org.
It's just another day. Doing my same old.
Today's music is by the California Honey Drops on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
The sun came up, Grandma called, and she's feeling fine. I put down the phone with a smiling face, yet I feel alright. But something always seems to come along to remind me that you're not around. Well, no. And I still wonder why did you have to go? And I still see your face every place I go. And I still break down and I cry. Every day is just the one more day without you.
Hello, do-it-yourselfer. Ever thought about gardening? If you can build that window box, you can build a raised bed in your backyard. Bonnie veggie and herb plants in raised beds make a fast weekend project with a big payback. Fresh, grow them yourself tomatoes and peppers, kale, basil and thyme, and so much more. Bonnie plants are healthy and strong and help jumpstart your garden. So get growing. Plans and how-tos at bonnieplants.com.
Hi, welcome back. I'm Allie, and you're listening to Just Food Stories on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm here with Ben Towle, and we've been talking a little bit about his trajectory from British, angry, sick youth to, you know, a restaurant chef opening the Fat Radish. Now, I'm going to fast forward a little bit because you're living in South Carolina, and what we want to really talk about is... what you're doing this bike ride. Mm-hmm. So I will give everyone an opportunity at the end of the program to donate lots and lots of money to awesome. Your donation page. But tell me a little bit about the bike ride and what you're doing and where you're going.
Yeah. So on the 23rd of this month, I am going to be biking across the country from Yorktown, Virginia to Florence, Oregon, 4,700 miles. And it came about through, I moved down to South Carolina in November to work on some new restaurant projects that are stalled. I was sitting at my desk, and a friend of mine sent me an email that he just rode across the Atlantic. And this is a guy who I was like, there's no way that...
Not road, R-O-D-E, road, R-O-W-E-D.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
rode in a boat with three other people. And totally inspiring, raised a great deal of money for charity. And so cool. I thought that I had this time, a little bit of time in my hands, and I have been so fortunate to be part of such with a great team, and had some success in New York with the restaurants, and I just wanted to do something where it was giving back and having a conversation about not really just sort of restaurants and high-end food, but mm-hmm. about food as a bigger picture, and see if the shift I've seen in New York that we were just discussing before the break, and Sysco and their healthy, their local food mm-hmm. Information on their trucks is shifting throughout the U.S. And I'm also at that time where I'm not from the U.S. Right. And living here for 10 years, I just wanted to get a better sense of that and see the country. Yeah. So I went and bought a bicycle, picked a route, and then I'm just going to be going with a photographer and sharing this journey and story and these conversations.
And having conversations with farmers across the country. In a way, you are embodying the connection between the restaurants and the growers. I mean, we talked about the food doing it, but you're doing it physically by taking your actual self and making that connection and going through. And you mentioned something in our conversation earlier, which I thought was really fascinating, that, you know, there's this, unfortunately, this correlation between like sports and athletics and like these sugary power drinks, you know, that are just water with some salt and a lot of sugar, so it doesn't taste like salt. I mean, exactly. It, from what I understand, and some like questionable chemicals to boot. And then there's this sort of connection between sort of the, you know, and I don't want to generalize, but you know, that yoga wellness world that is a little bit more about what you're not eating, you know, don't eat this, don't eat that. Well, I'm a this diet, you know, the restrictions kind of, like that asceticism almost. But what you're doing is sort of saying, well, there's this whole middle world of, you know, appreciating the outdoors and being athletic and not eating things because they don't have certain things, but just because they're really good and wholesome. And
yeah, I mean, I think that ultimately, if you're going to do any you know, major ride or any small activity, hiking and stuff, food is a fuel for that. And at the moment, the fuel for like athletes is all seen as this like quick high,
right,
chemically, you know, these sugary drinks. And I think if you actually ask athletes, it's sort of totally the opposite. So,
yeah, GORP, what happened to good old raisins and peas? Yeah. Did you have GORP in the UK, or did
no,
they call it that?
I don't think we did.
Do you know what that is? Good old raisins and peanuts.
There you go.
GORP.
Or I'd love to see the, you know, they on driving into Manhattan, there's a 5-hour energy commercial. And I'd love to see that just shifted every month with something like a bowl of brown rice or a bowl of chickpeas,
right,
and just say 12-hour energy.
I mean, you know, the old thing is like the growers don't have the money to spend on the marketing.
That's,
for their,
no,
you
I'm
know,
kidding.
For no, I know. But, you know, you can do that. So you're going to be taking this ride. You're going to be documenting these growers, having conversations.
Yeah, we're going to and you know, form an opinion through experience, mm-hmm. and continued experience, and raise some money for Just Food.
Great.
And you know, I'm really interested in this, in sort of the young generation, the youth program of inspiring people, like with through adventure,
mm-hmm.
and through something that's sort of quite extreme, to sort of capture people's imagination, to then engage them in the subject of food and realize that it can fuel you to do really cool things. And,
so
and
cool.
Rather,
so cool.
So that's the idea, and I'm so excited about it, and I'm excited just to see, you know,
where it takes where, you,
yeah,
literally,
where it,
right?
Where it takes you, and how those conversations develop.
Right. So, for those of you who want to help raise funds for Just Food, who want to check Ben out as he's going across the country, you can find more information about the project on arideinthecountry.com.
Mm-hmm.
That's Ben's website, which does include a donation page, and you can make a direct contribution to Just Food. Ben paid for his own bicycle.
Yeah, everything. I'm paying for everything. Every right. donation is 100% to Just Food.
That's good to know.
But if Trek are out there and want to give me my right, bicycle,
exactly.
I'll take
Trek. We could, you know, be connected with the food movement, Trek. Well, okay, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much,
Ben, and of course Evan, for engineering today's show. You can always find archived episodes of Just Food Stories on heritageradionetwork.org and as a podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Remember, if you have any questions for the program or Jackie or me, you can call 718-497-2128 or just email us at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Thank you so much for listening. Thanks again, Ben, and have a great ride.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening. California.